Hi and welcome to the speech. We will hear about high throughput DNA sequencing. Magnus will tell us about the basics. He will give us a short view in the history and in the future. And we will hear about chances, risks, and challenges of this new technology. Please welcome Magnus. He has programmed Wikipedia and works as a bioinformatician. I hate this word, I think. Okay.
Test 1, 2, okay. I realize it's a talk after dinner, or lunch for some. So if you fall asleep, try not to snore too loud, as you might wake your neighbor. I'll tell you a little about DNA sequencing and the rather remarkable progress this field made in the last year. And this is where I work and where most of this happens at the moment. It's in the UK, where we're all under tight surveillance, and I'll have some about this later. Okay, little basics. As you might remember, all life forms have DNA, and my laser pointer is not working. Oh, there it is. They all have DNA regardless of the level of complexity. And you can go down from chromosomes disentangle them and end up with a well-known double-stranded helix, which has four bases that are abbreviated with A, C, G, and T. Hence the title of my talk, All Your Base. And the genome size does not correspond with organism size, organism complexity. So we go from 3,500 bases with some bacteriophage, which is a virus that infects bacteria, all the way up to human with 3 billion. But then we find some single-celled organism with 670 billion bases. So sequencing is a challenge even with some apparently simple organisms. How did it all start? Started in the 1970s by a team, I think, in France. They sequenced the aforementioned bacteriophage, 3,600 bases, which took the entire team, I think, 5 or 6 years, and they were using this phage because it has RNA instead of DNA, which is related, but for technical reasons much more simple to sequence. Then people started developing DNA sequencing methods, and one of these was a wandering spot method, which yielded 24 bases per experiment, which involved quite a few people working on it. And then finally, in 1975, Frederick Sanger, who actually got not one but two Nobel Prizes in his life, he invented a method called chain termination sequencing, which quickly became the most used method because it actually yields some tangible results. So you have your strand of DNA. Here it's a single strand. They have to be separated for this. And then you have a so-called primer. The primer is a small DNA sequence, 20 or 30 bases. Okay, I hope this looks better. And this primer has to match your DNA you want to sequence. And from there, you extend one base, then you look what base it was, and you extend another base, and another, and another. And you have to record this somehow. And in the beginning, it was done with radioactive atoms that were incorporated in the bases that were added, which, having worked with radioactive gels, I can tell you it's a pain. Everything's slightly radioactive after the experiment, so you have to wait like 2-3 days for everything to cool down before you can continue to work. But then they replaced the radioactive parts with fluorescent dyes, and this is basically what most of the sequencing that was done till last year, or beginning of this year actually, and this is still done, like this looks like. You get these four overlaid curves in four different colors, and the peaks all mean it's one more base there. And this looks all pretty, but soon these peaks will start to degrade, and they will all bleed into each other, and then you have to stop with the sequencing because you can't tell the bases apart anymore. In practice, you get something between 300 and 1,000 bases per run, as we say, per experiment. And we need a primer to start with. And most of you will remember the Human Genome Project from the news in 2001 when the president of the US and the prime minister of the UK announced that the human genome is now sequenced, which it wasn't and it still isn't. And they started in 1990, or they started earlier, but they began the actual work in 1990, was exactly this process. And they started at one end of a chromosome, or at least a fragment of a chromosome. And then they was this primer here in red, and then they sequenced some more. So now they know the sequence of this fragment. And then they take the end of this fragment and use it as a primer to start the next part, and so on. Now, a human has 3 billion bases, and you can sequence roughly 500 to 600 per experiment. Now, this has several drawbacks. Not yet. Sorry. Because first, you have to wait for this run to complete before you can even think about starting this run because you don't know this yet. And then you have to wait for this to complete before you can start the next part. The other thing is that you actually need scientists to do this because you can't just take the end of this and run it. You have to actually look at this whole sequence, and sometimes you have to start a little more early because bases are not, they don't have the right GC content and blah blah. So this required all highly trained personnel. And then in came this guy, Craig Venter, who took a little more a business approach to this. Quite literally, he tried to beat the Human Genome Project with the sequencing and then patent all the genes. Which luckily didn't work out. Otherwise, it would all be a patent violation. And he said, well, I don't actually want to do this in a row like this, and then this, and then this. I just start somewhere. And I have my entire genome, and I just start somewhere and get 600 bases. And then I do this again and again and again. And if I do this often enough, I get the entire genome just by pure chance, and I get these fragments overlapping, And then I use a really big computer to puzzle them all together again. This means first there's little need for scientific supervision, so you can have some guy who basically reloads a machine, presses a button, and it produces another of these fragments, and then that gets stored, and then you do this again and again. And this scales up rather nicely, because you add more machines, you add more people who operate the machines, and you just scale up. This doesn't, the old method doesn't scale up, because it has to wait for each step. And this was done, so parts of the human genome were, even by the Human Genome Project, were assembled, were sequenced this way. And you might think, oh, that's great and all, and there's now this new technology, originally called Solexa. This was then bought by a company called Illumina, who basically bought everything in this segment of the market. Again, with a chain termination method, you get rather long reads compared to earlier methods, a few hundred bases in a stretch, but it's still few. So it takes a while it takes a machine a while to run one of these fragments. And you can scale it up, but it's still kind of slow. And Solexa takes this method that Craig Venter thought of, so-called shotgun sequencing, because like a shotgun, you don't have to aim that carefully, just aim in the general direction of the target and pull the trigger. And things will work out fine from there. So Solexa said, maybe we don't have to do these long sequences. We do shorter ones, like 30 bases, 40 bases. But we do lots of them. And with lots of them, and I'm not kidding. So what they do is they take a DNA raw material, and they fragment it to a certain size. So let's say 200, 300, 400 bases. So they just chop it apart in some nebulization processes. I don't even know what they do exactly, but this is what they end up with. So this is the original DNA fragmented to fragments of roughly the same size. And then they attach these fragments to glass chips. So millions and millions of these fragments now stick to glass chip. And then they use a method called PCR to amplify this. So each single fragment becomes a cluster of thousands and thousands of copies of this special fragment. And then they sequence these things all in parallel, and with each base, for each base, they stop and take photographs of this. And this is really photographs. It's a high-resolution digital camera. And this is what it looks like. It's not the screen from Poltergeist, and it's not something from the Hubble telescope. This is what the Solexa sequencing looks like. So it produces lots and lots and lots of these images, which then have to be analyzed. To the right, you see the Solexa machine. So each of these is one machine. And in here is a so-called flow cell, which is this thing here. It's rather tiny. It's like my laser pointer. And photographs are taken from this. So this is a very, very tiny portion of this flow cell. And if you do 35 bases, which is the one end of these fragments that we made previously, you will have to photograph this entire flow cell in this high resolution 35 times. And if you do what they usually do now, you do so-called paired reads. So you take both ends of this fragment. You have to do it 70 times. And this each machine per run produces 4 terabytes of image data. And this is already LZV compressed. Then computers run over this and try to piece together from these little gray dots that you saw on the previous slide what that means. So they have color filters there, and it's actually 4 colors, and you get 4 images for each possible base. And the output that I see, so I'm not working with the sequencing machines themselves, I work with the primary output, which is long lists of these data sets. So these 4 lines represent one of these fragments that were amplified and then sequenced. So this is an individual name. This is, I think, 37 bases from one end. This is 37 bases from the other end. And there are, in this case, I think, about 200 bases missing. It's not that I cut them off because they don't fit on the slide. I don't have that data. This data is lost. So you only know the ends of these fragments, but not what's in between. And then you have here a quality score, which is ASCII encoded, which basically says, oh, the machine was has a certain quality score of how sure the machine is that this is really an A in this case, which is, believe me, not a reliable metric, so it's best guess. So you get lots and lots of lines of this. So each flow cell has 8 lanes, which run in parallel and can carry different samples to be sequenced. And at the moment, I get per lane, I get about 9 million of these. So it's quite a bag of reads. And this is what they look like in a so-called alignment. So as you can see, the bases in one column are always the same. It's a little hard to see, probably. So everything here is a G, and these reads are aligned because there are multiple sequencing strands of the same original molecule. So this base here, for example, has been sequenced, I don't know, 20, 30 times in this process. This is the same view, a little more condensed, so there's a little more data on here. And maybe you can see this, the ends are in blue, and in gray is a missing part. So basically, down here, imagine this is your DNA, your chromosome, and it goes along here. And this is where these reads fit. They were fitted to a reference sequence. The blue means they are a perfect match, and the red means they are not matching the reference sequence at that point, but it's the best match that could be found. So when you see the red here is clustering at this position, then you can assume very safely from that this base in this sample is different than the one that was used as a reference. So you might say, okay, it's a new sequencing technology, so what, who cares? There's a website, a database on the internet called GeneBank that contains all the sequences of all the organisms that were ever sequenced in the last 35 years. So there's human, there's mouse, there's some fish, there's bacteria, there's yeast, there's everything. They were all sequenced with the old technology. And this amounts to 200 gigabases or billion bases in this database. This is the entire sum of human knowledge about sequences in organisms. The Sanger Center, which I showed you in the beginning, trialed a few of these Solexa machines at the end of last year, and they started basically production in January. And in the first 3 months, they produced more than that. So in 3 months, they produced more sequencing data than the entire world in 35 years, using 28 machines and 20 people to run them. And as I said, Sanger trialed these machines end of 2007. So when they started in 2008, it was still rather experimental process. I was still learning how to use them correctly, what parameters to set to get the maximum output. And of course, they improved on this, and each machine is churning out 20 gigabases per run now, which is 75 terabases or 7.5 terabases or 7,500 gigabases per year is the current output. Is actually a little more like 9 terabases at the moment, because this was written last month. So you can see how this is changing, and it is changing, and whole new modes are becoming available right now. So they're increasing the read lengths now from 35 or 37 to 50. I've seen 50. Works very well. There are apparently trials with 76 and even 100, which would put this in the same ballpark as the original Sanger sequencing, which made one of these reads per run, and this does like 9 million per run. So this 7.5 terabases will at least double next year. It will probably be more. How am I doing? Oh, okay. So this is not just, oh, it's a new technology that works a little better. This is a whole paradigm shift in this area of science, and it has great potential, but it also has, it poses great problems, because until beginning of this year, scientists kept running around, so biologists, medical people kept running around. Oh, I need my favorite gene sequenced now. Why do I have to wait so long? And this year, and I've repeatedly heard people say that, here's your gene sequence. Oh, we didn't sequence it once, we sequenced it 20 times because we had the spare capacity. And I said, oh, what am I supposed to do with all this? It's a real problem, because there's no algorithm, there's no software, there's no concept of how to deal with this, with all this data. Because for the last few decades, everything that was developed on the principle, oh, we have a sequence, now we have 20 people who can look at this single sequence. And now people are drowning in data, and they don't know what to do with it. Problem gets worse if you realize this. We let the computer puzzle it together to one sequence. It doesn't work. What you get is you have software that can puzzle these things together to long pieces, 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 bases, but that's the end of it, because some parts in natural DNA, in our DNA, in every organism's DNA, has certain structures like repeats. So it goes on AT, AT, AT for thousands of bases. And unless you can sequence through this entire stretch and see both ends of this repeat sequence, you don't know how long it is, and you have no way of finding out how long it is. And so every time this occurs, you need some human to make a guess and puzzle it together. Well, let's say you can puzzle it together. You have a new genome now of some species you have no knowledge about otherwise in terms of sequence. This stuff needs to be annotated. It's just a bunch of very long strings, and no one knows what they mean. So you have to go in there and mark up, this is a gene. And it's not as trivial as it sounds, because even today, there is no good way for automated annotation for this stuff. If you let the best software run over a human genome today, you'll get probably 50% false positives and 50% of the genes that it misses. So automatic annotation is not the solution, at least not now. And you can only throw so many people at this because, again, people have to be trained for this. They have to know what they're doing to annotate this stuff. And I know some of these people, and they say you can do this for 2, maximum 3 years, and after that you go crazy whenever you see a screen with all this DNA on it, because it just, you stare at this stuff 8 hours a day, and it's like a very complicated Tetris. And you can play this occasionally, but after 3 years of doing this every single day for 8 hours, you just run away screaming. Of course, I want to mention that other technology we use. So sequencing machines put out lots of data, and it's really lots, and it's getting more. As I said, they get more data from the machines, so it means more data is coming onto the servers. So currently we are generating about 300 terabytes per month, and that needs to be stored somewhere. We do have 3 petabytes in our farm at the moment, more or less. Even the systems people couldn't tell me how much exactly it is, because they're too busy adding new hard drives. This is all that some people do. They just plug in new hard drives until the rack is full. Actually, with that, they are losing currently. So just beginning of December, basically last thing I heard was they locked down some of the user space on the hard disks because sequencing machines kept churning out new data. They didn't know where to put it. So I hope it didn't blow to, I don't know where, when I come back in January and find the thing has become a giant meltdown. Backup is a problem. They have robots. They have robots to store the stuff on tape. So the robots are just changing tapes, putting the tape in. It's written, taken out. It has automated IDs and barcodes on it and all kinds of things. This is running 24 hours a day. But they have a backlog of, I think, half a year right now. Which is not backupped. There's a mirrored hard disk, probably in the same rack. The computing people don't view it as a large problem. As you can see, they just say, "Oh, it's faster to rerun everything anyway." They do have frozen copies of all the DNA, let's say, sequenced, so they could actually go back and resequence the stuff. It won't be exactly the same data because this whole process is rather random, but the results from it, they should be the same again. Should be. Believe me, I've seen stuff there. Also, this whole analysis is kind of demanding. So just running the image analysis on 4 terabytes per run kind of takes some steam. So we have at the moment about 4,000 CPU cores in the farm, and many of them are used for this image analysis. And then, of course, what do I do with these lines of reads I showed you? This stuff has to run somewhere as well to give me a better picture of what it actually is and what's in there. Why? Why are we doing this? Why do we bother? So what are we looking at? So this is kind of a tree of life. And I've marked some of the things we look at. This is the whole primate thing here. And there's related mouse and pig. There's zebrafish, because zebrafish is a model organism in biology, which has its own problems, because after they sequenced the mouse and they were still sequencing human, they said, oh, let's do zebrafish. Turn out, oh, we need this amount of DNA. And they calculated, and a single fish doesn't have enough DNA. So they took, and you can believe this literally, they took, I think, 4 or 5 fish, put them in a blender. Mooly Lex, you remember that. And sequenced from there. Turns out individual zebrafish have these strange polymorphisms. For the same area with 5 fish, you get 5 different results. And assembling that is kind of tricky. So they're now doing zebrafish with a new technology, which has its own drawbacks, because currently these reads are actually too short to reassemble a completely new genome. This will be fixed with the 50 and 100 base pairs that we're seeing now, that are coming through next month, beginning of 2009. But currently it's basically not possible, because it's just the reads are too short. And what we can do is, if we have a reference genome, so the same species or a related species, we can map this stuff back and see, okay, all this is identical. I see this in the reference and in the new stuff. And then we can look at the rest and say, okay, this kind of fits here. So maybe it's just a small variation, and then we have a whole bucket of things that don't go anywhere. And there you can try and reassemble it, because there are probably new genes or genes that are so altered from the reference that they're not recognizable anymore. We have some worms, some plants, lots of bacteria. Fun thing is, bacteria are so small you can probably bundle a few per lane. Some guy gave us Anopheles samples. So this is a mosquito that carries the malaria parasite. And they said, okay, here's a sample of Anopheles. We cleaned this and all. So we extracted DNA, put it on the Solexa machine, got lots of reads back. Turns out it's not Anopheles. We don't actually know what it is. Our best guess is they accidentally took something from the mosquito gut, because we partially assembled some of mosquito gut bacteria, found some fun viruses, and I found about 1% Yersinia pestis, which causes black death. So I'm quite glad I'm not in sample preparation. We have some trypanosomes and malaria in red, because this is what I'm actually working on. And there's also fun stuff being done. So some people are trying to extract Neanderthal DNA from teeth they found, because that's the most likely place to find DNA after tens of thousands of years, because a tooth actually protects the DNA inside, or it can protect the DNA. They found some frozen mammoth and in the Russian permafrost, and they dug this out, and I heard some people ate this stuff. It was still fresh. Probably not true, I hope. So they're assembling the woolly mammoth, and I think they're modeling it on some African elephant, not sure. Just a few months ago, I saw the complete platypus genome, so this is Schnabeltier auf Deutsch, which is fun because it's kind of a little bit of everything, like PHP. Okay, now you think, okay, now I've heard enough, I'll buy it, I want my genome sequenced. In the Human Genome Project, the Human Genome Project cost all in all about $500 million for one genome. The method invented by Sanger, the chain termination method, which was used there, is still available, of course. Also, we threw all the machines out right now. And thanks to Craig Venter and his shotgun sequencing, cost is down to about $10 million for one genome. With the current state of Solexa sequencing, you get one genome for $100,000, but you get it with a so-called 20x coverage, which means on average, each position has been sequenced 20 times. Why do I need this? If you want the complete genome, everything for sure, you have to go to like 20x coverage, because it's not equally distributed. So there are some regions that have 50x coverage, are sequenced 50 times, and some that are only sequenced 10 times. And so the lower you go with your with the coverage you aim for, the less likely it gets that you get all of your genome sequenced. But if you look at 1x coverage, theoretically, would be about, $5,000 actually. $5,000. And sometimes you don't need the entire genome, because only a small portion of our genome actually is genes. Most of it is whatever it is, we don't really know what it is. They used to say it's garbage, but it's not. We don't know yet. Probably PGP. And if you just go for this coding region, so the regions that are actually genes, you'll drop some order of magnitudes in this cost. And so Sanger and other institutes are currently running a 1,000 genomes project, which will sequence all the genes of 1,000 people from various parts of the world, and then look at this and compare it and look for possible disease markers, so there are people with certain diseases in there, and see what comes up. That's still too expensive for you and me to buy like a $100,000. Still, well, have to let go of this Porsche. But there were these companies like this 23andMe, which is actually owned by some guy who also owns large parts of Google. And they said sell it for $500, $400, whatever. Because they don't do sequencing, they do another technology called genotyping. They check for single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs in short, which is basically a one base change at a certain position. So at this position, they say normally people have an A there, but this guy has a T there. That would be a SNP, so a one base change, basically. And there are chips, there are not computer chips, they're glass chips. Companies they can prefix this position, a copy of this position, and the surrounding genomic region, like a few dozen bases in either direction, on this chip, and they do one of them with the so-called normal variation and the alternate variation. So one was an A, one was a T. And then you basically pour your DNA on that, and whatever copy you have will stick to one of these prefixed sequences, and you can detect this again with fluorescence, again with photographic modes. So there's again a picture of a chip, and it's glowing in pretty colors. And because you know where each variation is positioned on the chip, you can say, oh, I see this variation in the sample. There are currently chips that can carry 1 million positions on a single chip. So when I started studying, this was barely developed. This was there was an experimental chip that had 10, not 10 million, 10 of these things on it. And they're now up to 1 million. I think next year we'll see 2 million. This is much cheaper, much faster, and easier to handle than sequencing. But it has several big drawbacks as well. It finds only known variations. So you have to actually look for a variation in order to see it. If there's a variation in the sample that no one ever heard of, and or no one's testing on this chip, you don't see it. Also, it's limited to these single nucleotide polymorphisms, so larger variation is usually not detected. And there's also high error rate when used on an individual, which doesn't invalidate its use entirely, because there are lots of studies currently done that sequence or that genotype, let's say 5,000 people from Finland, you have errors there. You have on the chip you have bases that are not detected in some samples, but if you have 5,000 data points for a single position, well, if you lose 200, so what? This is very useful for large-scale studies, and we had some large study coming through like middle of the year. Someone might have heard about it. It was big in Nature. They have detected lots of markers for obesity and for all kinds of diseases, and they're still working on this data because it's a statistical process with 1 million positions and let's say 15,000 people tested, and each of these people has 1 million positions tested. You can't actually look at it by hand. You'll have to use statistical methods, and they in turn can be kind of error prone in either direction. When I say all the sequencing is still too expensive, and maybe it also takes too long, because one run can take several days on Solexa. Maybe Moses doesn't concern us yet. However, there are a few companies who are developing the next generation sequencing. And what they have is pretty scary. Most of it is actually believable. So it's there's some vaporware out there, sure, but some of what they have is real. They've shown it in small variation, and they're in the process of scaling this up. So one of them is Pacific Biotech. Just a note: I don't have shares of any of these companies. So they do something called single enzyme sequencing. They use the enzyme that our bodies or many organisms use to duplicate their DNA. And they use it for sequencing, which means it's very accurate and very fast. So what they do is they take a single enzyme and they take, again, some glass chip or whatever, and they punch a 20 nanometer hole in this. And they fix this single enzyme in this hole, and then they basically, again, with fluorescent markers, watch the enzyme run through the DNA. And this will actually yield thousands of bases, so very, very long reads with very, very high accuracy. But it's you might think, okay, it's very nice, but it's only one enzyme. But they multiplex it, so they put thousands, ten thousands, hundred thousand, I don't know how many of these holes, with each as an enzyme in it, on a single chip, and they all run in parallel. And they claim they will eventually do one human genome in a few minutes for $100. Announced for 2010, so around the corner. 1 year and, well, 3 days or something. this is quite, maybe the end result is not that extreme, though I imagine it could be. And if you think about it, at that point, the sequencing centers like the Sanger will basically die off, because every single hospital will have at least one of these. If you come in and you have some disease that even house can't diagnose, and you have a gold or platinum credit card, they'll take a sample of your DNA and pour it onto that machine, and a few minutes later they can tell you, oh, you have this and this and this and this genetic disease. There are other companies, so there's Helicos, which will do single molecule sequencing, which will have several advantages. One, you need very little DNA for this, so here's CSI Next Generation. And you have Nanopore, they do something similar to Pacific Biotech. Some social and political news. So I'm living and working in the UK of my own free will. I thought I'd gather some of the news that are heard while I was there, which kind of relate to this new technology. So some British scientists say they can predict someone's last name based on their DNA. This only works for males, because the Y chromosome is only passed from father to son, like the last name. In most cases, at least. If the police goes out and they find some male DNA, and they put it through some genotyping or sequencing or whatever, let's say some of your male relatives got into the system somehow, and by pure chance, Their DNA looks in some parts like the suspects. You're on the list. I have no doubt about that. This is a current situation in the UK. They're very big on these DNA fingerprints, which is a little different than genotyping or sequencing. It's a little more simplistic, but still. So they have 7.5% of the population, some say 10%, already in there. And that's people who were not even charged with a crime. They were taken to the police station for some reason, and they took the DNA and then said, okay, you can go now, we have your DNA. There was a suggestion that for not wearing your seatbelt, the police should be able to take your DNA and keep it indefinitely. I don't think it's in power now, but I wouldn't be surprised. For fighting the terrorists, we will have this soon. You will not be surprised that the European Court of Human Rights just a month ago ruled this database violates basic human rights. No one in the UK did anything about this so far, and I don't expect they will. So in the last 5 minutes, I'll just briefly show you why I'm still working with this, if it's so evil. Because it actually has some nice applications. So I'm working on malaria. Malaria infects about up to half a billion people each year, with 1 to 2 million deaths each year, mostly children under 5 because the immune system is not developed enough. And so what we do is we use this new technology to sequence individual parasites that were taken from people. So basically blood from the arm is enough to sequence the parasite that resides in the red blood cells. We've taken samples basically from everywhere. The ones from the UK you see here were taken from an airport, and no one knows where the people came from. So we just put them there. We have 95 samples now, as I said. And here's one thing we actually did with it. When we compare these sequences and then group them by a similarity, let's say this is for the mathematically inclined, this is a principal component analysis. And as you can see, we can tell apart African samples and Papua New Guinea and Southeast Asia pretty well. So this is Brazil, which apparently is like Southeast Asia, which brings me to some other things. We are planning on doing a public website where we will show distilled views of this. So this is a mock-up from another paper, actually, but we'll try to use this technology for basically using live data, that we can see where outbreaks are, where resistance outbreaks are, how parasites move, how fast they move, where they move, if they have roots on which they move, if they move with the mosquitoes, if they move more with the people. Because if you get malaria in Africa and then move to Asia, and a mosquito stings you, it will suck up some of these parasites, and if it infects the next person, he'll get your strain that you carried with you. There's also this could lead to these population networks. Just a mock-up graphic here. There's lots more we can do with this. Multiclonal infection, so a single patient can be infected by multiple strains of malaria simultaneously, which is probably not fun. As I said, how the parasites travel. Large-scale variations, so parts of the DNA can be deleted, new genes can be inserted, or sequence can be inverted. Copy number variations, there can be multiple copies of a single gene, which relates to resistance, are completely new genes that somehow more or less spontaneously evolved, and that's it.